Tom, courage is our job. We're responsible to set the example for our soldiers. 5-0, the voice sounded in my right earphone. Rainbow 4, say again your target coordinates. The man speaking in my left earphone was Iron Horse 6, one of the battalion's company commanders. His unit was in heavy contact down in the smoking string of houses, factories, and warehouses bunched along the south bank of the Kendoy Canal. With a May sun pouring through the little chopper's plastic bubble, even at 1,200 feet, the cramped cockpit was an oven. Lieutenant Colonel Eric Antilla and I had been riding in these H-23 Raven command and control helicopters for the first 3 days of this seemingly endless engagement. In the H-23, the pilot flew from the center of the narrow bench, the commander on his left, the artillery liaison officer to the right. There wasn't sufficient radio capacity for me to communicate with both the infantry companies maneuvering below and the artillery batteries who were providing their fire support. So in the 2 months I'd been flying as Antilla's battalion liaison officer, I developed my own Rube Goldberg communication system. I wired the right earphone in my green aircrew helmet to the Prick 25 radio gripped between my knees, and that was tuned to the artillery fire support channel. My left earphone was wired to the helicopter comm channel, which the colonel used to talk to his company commanders and platoon leaders. My helmet mic was wired to the ground unit maneuver frequency, and I used the Prick 25 handset to reach fire support. At first, trying to work this jerry-rigged system was like being split down the middle, but I'd gotten used to it. And a damn good thing, too. The battle which had been raging along the canal and through Saigon's southern districts was the biggest engagement since February's Tet Offensive. In fact, at dawn that morning, before we climbed aboard the chopper, I'd heard someone on Armed Forces radio calling the fight a second Tet. At least 5 North Vietnamese and Viet Cong battalions had moved north through the rice paddies and assaulted a small Republic of Vietnam Regional Force guard post at the long concrete Y span across the wide shipping channel called the Y Bridge. Acting on intelligence, Lieutenant Colonel Antilla had moved the battalion and all its tracks north on the afternoon of May 6th. Before daylight the next morning, the companies were engaged in street fighting with well-armed and well-trained enemy troops. The NVA and Viet Cong were determined to cross the bridge and fight their way 4 kilometers north into the heart of the capital. That first morning, our battalion had engaged the superior enemy force alone on the south side of the canal. But the 9th Division had fed more and more battalions into the fight, while all the liaison officers and their commanders buzzed overhead working fire support. In the battalion's sector, I called in probably 100 fire missions and airstrikes, pounding the enemy among pastel stucco cinder block houses and factories. This had been a prosperous pro-government district, built largely with American aid, a showcase of progress. I regretted destroying this neighborhood, but the enemy was using these buildings to fire RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, machine guns, recoilless rifles down on our troops. By the second day, I was directing the fires of as many as 5 artillery battalions. The Air Force was flying nonstop support from nearby Tan Sanut Air Base, and the combination of artillery fire and 500-pound bombs was devastating the enemy. May 10th was day 3. The previous night had been relatively quiet, just mortars and 107mm rockets every hour or so to keep us awake, but Charlie was back in force at dawn. By 10:40 hours, the companies were maneuvering south along a main road attempting to encircle the Viet Cong dug into the ruins of what had been an industrial complex. I was running on canteens of coffee and a total of roughly 3 hours sleep in the past 4 nights and days. 5-0, the Battery Fire Direction Center called again in my right earphone. Did not copy target coordinates, over. I shook myself awake and studied the plastic-covered map board on my lap. Foxtrot Tango 465874, over. We were hovering right above the target, the safest place because our incoming artillery shells would drop past our helicopter on an angle. Holding a hover exposed us to intermittent ground fire, but it couldn't be helped. In any event, flying with Lieutenant Colonel Antilla was always exciting. The man was fearless. Late the previous afternoon, we'd taken a machine gun round right through the bubble canopy. until I just leaned over and shouted in the roar of the slipstream, "Tom, I don't know about you, but this makes me nervous." "Shot, over," the battery called. A volley of shells was on its way to the targets immediately below us. I closed my eyes for a second, images of my life rushing through my mind like a vivid, fragmented dream. Driving down to Mexico with my fraternity brothers, the radio blaring Hank Williams. I was trying to tell one of my complicated Aggie jokes, but the music was too loud. "Splash! Over!" the voice sounded. 5 seconds till impact. I closed my eyes again. Now I was working with my father stripping down an old Evinrude outboard, or a tractor transmission connected to a truck that was somehow part of an electric generator. "She's a tough one, Tommy Ray." I opened my eyes, squinting against the sun. The 155-millimeter shells exploded 40 meters south and 60 meters east of the target. "Left 50, add 50, over," I called. As the battery acknowledged, my left earphone squawked with a frantic call from a forward observer with one of the companies. "Heavy contact!" They were taking RPG fire from a warehouse beside the highway. I leaned close to my map and found the coordinates. Checking my clipboard, I identified the nearest battery, a 105-millimeter firebase 10 clicks down the road. "In contact. Fire mission." When I called the target coordinates, I added Eric Antilla's authorizing initials, Echo Alpha. Since the first day of the fight, he had told me to use his authorization without consulting him whenever one of the units was in contact. They had been in contact continuously, and I had used the initials Echo Alpha repeatedly. Short of fuel, we landed in a field near the canal and staggered to another H-23 command and control chopper. I had just enough time to take a leak and drink some more cold coffee. By late afternoon, the enemy attack had broken, and our tracks sped south down the highway, firing at small groups of Viet Cong and North Vietnamese fleeing into the newly flooded second crop rice paddy. I woke up when the Huey from the U.S. Army Vietnam headquarters clattered in and landed at the battalion command post. The fighting had been over for 4 days. Eric Antilla was up at division headquarters with the other battalion commanders reporting on the engagement. Some two-star general and two colonels climbed out of the helicopter and asked for the 560 artillery liaison officer. I buttoned my shirt and saluted. None of the senior officers shook my hand, nor did they smile or exchange the usual pleasantries. One of the colonels was from the inspector general's office. The other was a JAG lawyer. He presented a printed form and directed me to swear that my statement was voluntary, true, and complete. What the fuck is all this about? Half an hour later, as we drove from blasted house to shattered factory, I'd begun to figure it out. "What hit this building?" the IG colonel asked, pointing to a ruined warehouse beside the canal. 500-pound high-drag bomb, sir," I answered. "And you ordered that airstrike?" "Yes, sir, I did." The questions were all the same. We spent an hour driving through the area reviewing targets on which I had ordered fire missions, or airstrikes, or both. By the end of that hour, I realized what was going on. These sour-faced senior rear echelon motherfuckers were looking for someone to court-martial for employing excessive force in case there was trouble over the destruction of this district on the outskirts of Saigon. And every time we stopped, either the general or one of the colonels would ask, "And you're sure that the unit you supported was in contact?" It looked like I might be going to DeRose, all right. Head on back home sooner than I'd expected. Wearing handcuffs. We were examining a burned-out house near the command post when Lieutenant Colonel Antilla's muddy jeep pulled up. He saluted the officers, walked along with us as we continued the inspection of the ruined buildings. After he'd heard two of the team's formally phrased queries, Eric Antilla stepped between the general and me. "Sir," he said quietly, looking the man right in the eye, "those are excellent questions, but you're asking the wrong man. The duty log will reflect that every fire mission and every airstrike was cleared by Echo Alpha. That's Eric Antilla. Lieutenant Franks was simply relaying my orders." The general squinted at Antilla, and he looked at me. "Lieutenant, you're dismissed," he finally said. and he turned to the JAG officer who swore in Lieutenant Colonel Antilla. Over the years, I've replayed that drama in my mind thousands of times, and I've learned more about Lieutenant Colonel Eric Antilla since that hot afternoon along the Kendoy Canal. He'd been slated for retirement following this tour, a combat tour that he had specifically requested from his desk job as a nuclear weapons officer in Europe. He didn't have to risk his life in Vietnam, and he certainly didn't have to risk a court-martial, a dishonorable discharge, and the loss of his pension to take care of an OCS lieutenant. During my months in combat, I'd come to understand that a soldier owes loyalty to his unit and to his boss. A leader must be able to count on the complete support of his subordinates. As Eric Antilla climbed into that jeep and assumed full responsibility for my actions during the Battle of the Wye Bridge, however, I realized that loyalty not only flows up the chain of command, it flows down as well. Eric Antilla retired from the Army as a colonel shortly after having bravely commanded one of the best battalions in Vietnam. I loved and respected him until his death in 2003, and all he taught me at the Wye Bridge lives on to this day. Austin, Texas, November 1968. I was home with my parents in Austin. Long, hot showers, my father's charcoal steaks, my mother's cherry pie with ice cream. Yes, ma'am, I'd love another piece. I slept under clean sheets, the window open to the cool breeze. No mosquito net, no sandbags, no elimination rounds. As the saying goes, I decompressed. Raking leaves in my folks' yard one bright fall morning, I thought about the future. In less than a year, I'd be a civilian. I was feeling ready. Ready at last to get a degree, perhaps even go to law school. But it wouldn't be easy sitting in class beside guys who'd used student deferments to protest the war, while blue-collar kids who'd never made it to college were out on the listening posts or humping the patties in the Delta sun. One evening after dinner, Mother helped me with my dress uniform as I prepared to report for duty to Fort Sill, my next duty assignment. She sewed the colorful 9th Infantry Division patch on the shoulder of my right sleeve, designating I'd served in combat with that unit. My dad came into the kitchen and watched as I pinned on the campaign ribbons and decorations. Those are oak leaf clusters. I tapped the little pins on the ribbons for second and third awards of the same medal. In his deliberate way, my dad counted. Three purple hearts, he said. I was a big target. I'd actually been wounded several more times. The purple hearts only signified the wounds for which I'd been sent to the hospital. And all these medals with V. V stands for Valor, Dad. Bronze stars, air medals, Army commendation medals. They sort of gave them out in Cracker Jack boxes. I don't believe that, son. He ran his hand down the green serge of my uniform. We're so proud of you. The television was playing in the living room. More protests. Loud. Chaotic. When we landed back at Travis, they advised us to wear civvies on the plane ride home. People don't respect the uniform anymore, Dad, I said. My father frowned. Some don't. Most people do. You wear it and be proud, son. You bet. The next morning when my dad was at work and Mother was shopping with a neighbor, I picked up the phone. The girl who answered at the sorority house promised that Kathy Carley would be right there. I started sweating, like waiting for the splash of an artillery spotting round close to our own position. "This is Kathy." Her voice was as I remembered, gentle but strong. "It's me." "Oh, Tom, are you all right?" "I'm great. Even better now that I'm talking to you. Listen, I'm about to drive up to Oklahoma. Do you think maybe we could have a date?" "That would be fine, Tom." Kathy and I were married in the Fort Sill New Post Chapel on Saturday, March 22, 1969. Her wedding gown was beautiful. I bought a formal dress blue uniform, even though I'd needed only a few more months, since I'd promised my new wife I was going to get out of the Army. We left the chapel arm in arm beneath the traditional arch of sabers. Our first house was a little renter in Lawton, right next to Fort Sill. It was very much like the place Glenn Stewart and I had shared when I'd met Kathy. As she finished her student teaching at Lawton High School, I commanded a training battery in the artillery school. We were both busy, but about as much in love as you can be. Our daughter Jacqueline was born in May 1971 as I was finishing my degree in business administration, financed by the Army's degree completion program at the University of Texas, Arlington. In many ways, the little tasks of parenthood, cradling the baby in my arms, warming a bottle, rocking her back to sleep in the middle of the night, helped put my lingering memories of Vietnam into perspective. I was proud of my profession, but there was so much more to life than weapons and tactics. With 20-month-old Jackie in tow, Kathy and I arrived in Germany on a snowy morning in February 1973. A week later, now a captain, I took command of Howitzer Battery, 1st Squadron, 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. Serving in Germany in the 1970s had its challenges, not the least of which was leading an inordinately high number of troops who did not want to be in the Army. Digging out the rotten apples would be my top priority. Over the next several months, in cooperation with the MPs, we broke up several dope deals, resulting in 7 arrests that led to courts-martial. But the dopers weren't the only problem. A number of troopers just didn't give a damn about the Army anymore, if they ever had. Some had served in Vietnam before the United States pulled out the last combat units after the signing of the Paris Peace Accord. But most of the troublemakers had never heard a cap gun fired in anger. They were simply rotten apples, soured by the anti-military mood of the times, poisoning the morale of a much larger number of young men who were trying to do their jobs. The new Army, with volunteer enlistees filling the ranks, did not need these troublemakers. I got rid of the bad apples in that unit. I couldn't change the whole Army, but I could reshape the small unit I commanded. In January 1975, I was assigned to the 84th Armored Engineer Company. The 84th was the regiment's basket case. It was loaded with malcontents, most of them draftees, finishing their service. They're about as close to a mob in uniform as I've seen, Colonel Hudacek told me. He'd relieved the company commander and called me in to take his place. I took command at a breakfast ceremony in the company mess hall and then walked into the orderly room. When I entered, the company clerk hardly glanced up from his penthouse. "Get me the platoon leaders and the first sergeant," I ordered. "I'm your new commander." There must have been something in my tone that got him motivated. "Yes, sir." He dropped the magazine and grabbed the phone. "Right away, sir." What followed was a long, tiring day spent talking individually with a parade of junior officers, platoon sergeants, and senior non-commissioned officers. There were several potential leaders among them, but they were tentative, dispirited, uncertain of their authority. The company had already been cut to about 70% strength through the expeditious discharge program and administrative elimination process and through courts-martial. "The ones we've got left just don't give a shit, sir," the first sergeant said, adding that many of the remaining troops had been restricted to the post as punishment for disciplinary infractions. "We'll work on that, First Sergeant," I told him. It was late when I left the office. Instead of driving home, I decided to tour the company's corner of the base. My last stop was the notorious fourth floor. The quarters' linoleum was filthy. There was obscene graffiti on the walls, and I could smell the hashish. A tall, husky private in dirty fatigues walked toward me with a sour expression on his face. "Fuck you," he said as he passed. I couldn't believe what I'd just heard. I spun around to see who he was talking to. There was nobody else in the hallway. I suddenly pictured all those young troopers who'd lost their lives serving, doing their duty in Vietnam. And this malcontent punk didn't deserve to wear the same uniform. I lost it. "Hey, you," I said. The soldier turned around to face me. I grabbed his shoulders and slammed him against the wall and stared into his eyes. He stood there as if in shock as I turned and walked away. Colonel Hudacek was still in his office, wrapping up the day's paperwork when I knocked on the door. "Tom," he said, "how'd the first day go?" "I have a report that I just struck a soldier, sir." The colonel nodded somberly. I sighed. 10 years in the Army and it had all come to this. Officers do not strike soldiers. I'd be lucky if the court-martial resulted in an honorable discharge. In any event, my future in the military was over. "What happened?" I explained. Colonel Hudacek frowned. "Captain, you cannot lay hands on a trooper." "Yes, sir." He pointed. "Go stand in the corner." I went to the corner of Colonel Hudacek's office and stared at him. "No, you don't understand, Captain. Stand in the corner. Face the wall." I turned and faced the wall. Less than a minute passed. "Go home, Tom. Get some sleep. I want you with your company early tomorrow morning. You've got a lot of work to do with those soldiers." Standing in the corner. Exceptional punishment for exceptional times. As I left his office, I thought of Colonel Eric Antilla at the Y Bridge. Loyalty still ran up, and it still ran down the Army's chain of command. After 18 months as an inspector general, I'd worked for Army Chiefs of Staff General Bernie Rogers and General Shai Meyer, helping prepare them for congressional testimony. I'd discovered that some members of Congress, confronted with a choice between the nation's interests and those of their constituents, when it came to a pork barrel weapons contract, for example, or beefing up a base back in the district, were all too eager to vote for the folks back home. Tommy Franks matured as a bureaucrat during those 4 years. The idealism of youth was augmented by the pragmatism of politics. 6.5 years later, 1981, my boots were deep in the springtime mud of another West German training range. I was now a lieutenant colonel commanding the 2nd Battalion 78th Field Artillery, a self-propelled 155mm howitzer unit of the 1st Armored Division. We were stationed in the Bavarian town of Bamberg, but we spent much of the year out on field exercises. I was glad to get back to troops. Commanding a battalion is one of the most demanding but most rewarding jobs in the Army, and I was fortunate to have the 278 for 3 years instead of the usual two. My 565 troopers had proven to me that the all-volunteer Army was a success. Drug use in the ranks was no longer a problem. A service-wide program of random testing identified dopers, and then they were quickly discharged. Open hostility between the races had disappeared, as black and Hispanic sergeants and officers had taken their rightful places in the service. In this critical area, the Army was leading the evolution of American society. The troops recognized once again that wearing a military uniform was something they could take pride in. If they were led well, these soldiers would spend nights and weekends in the field, on dangerous live fire exercises, in any weather, eating cold sea rations and snatching sleep under dripping ponchos when they could, performing up to exacting standards. In July 1985, after a year at the War College, I was assigned to Fort Hood, Texas, as the Deputy Operations Officer of 3rd Corps, which included most of the Army's heavy divisions based in the States. I was leaving for the office one Wednesday morning in August 1986 when the phone rang. "Tommy Ray?" Mother's voice was strained. "Your father fell down and he's in Midland Memorial Hospital. They think he's had a stroke." Driving too fast on Texas state highways, Kathy, Jackie and I reached Midland by late afternoon. My parents had returned there in the 1970s. Dad had taken a job with B&B Vending Company, fixing and selling jukeboxes all around West Texas. It was the kind of work he did well. In fact, he'd bought the old jukebox from the Midland High Youth Center and refurbished it as a Christmas present for us. At age 72, on medication for hypertension, he still worked his normal 6 days a week, all of which made it more of a shock to see him lying unconscious in the ICU. My father had always had a presence of calm strength. Now he seemed helpless. The next day he was awake and coherent, but he drifted in and out of consciousness. He squeezed my hand. "When you and Kathy come home," he said weakly, "we'll go quail hunting." "I'll get another dog, Tommy Ray." "That'll be great, Dad." He spoke with joy of the cruise that he and Mother had taken, a gift we'd given them for their 50th wedding anniversary. Then he slept again. Lucid once more, he looked at me intently. "I'm so proud of you. You've come a long way since that day in Austin when we put you on that Greyhound." When we finally left, the doctors told us he was resting comfortably. And that evening, Kathy and Jackie and I went to a movie to relieve the stress. but coming attractions were still playing when I was paged. "Oh, Tommy Ray," my mother sobbed on the phone, "your father just passed away." As Kathy and I knelt in the hospital chapel, I smiled, remembering all the times I'd called him for advice. "Dad, the Olds is running a little hot. Change the fan belt and put in a new thermostat, son. Well, the commode in the guest bathroom keeps dripping. Get a pencil. Now, here's what you need to do to fix it." Once I'd called from the suburbs of northern Virginia when the garbage disposal had suddenly quit. "I guess I'll have to get a new one, Dad." "Well, Tommy Ray, take a flashlight," he said in his patient way. "Get down on your knees and look at the bottom of the unit. If there's a little red button sticking out, push it in. That's the reset button." Of course, he'd been right. Again. For years after my father's funeral on that hot summer morning in Midland, I found myself reaching for the phone, reaching out for his wisdom, his counsel. I still wish he were here to give it. June 1989. Jackie had just graduated from Colleen High School, and I counted the blessings of having been at Fort Hood the previous 4 years. Jackie planned to attend Drury College in Springfield, Missouri, where she'd received a swimming scholarship. And now I, as a colonel, had been selected to become the 1st Cavalry Division Chief of Staff. A few months later, I got the news that my name was on the Brigadier General promotion list. As the Chief of Staff, I was up to my elbows in paperwork, completing an after-action report on Desert War Games out at the sprawling National Training Center in Fort Irwin, California. The next summer, I received orders to report for duty as the Assistant Commandant of the Artillery School at Fort Sill. Now, that was a job where I could apply my theories on speed and firepower. But those orders would soon change. On Thursday, August 2, 1990, thousands of Iraqi troops and hundreds of armor vehicles rolled into Kuwait and occupied the small Arabian Gulf state after a brief one-sided battle. The new division commander, Brigadier General John Talilli, called me at home that night. "Tom, we better dust off our overseas deployment plans." "Roger that, sir." The UN Security Council censured Iraq and demanded that Saddam Hussein withdraw his occupation force from Kuwait immediately. But Saddam declared the formal annexation of Kuwait as Iraq's 19th province. More UN Security Council resolutions followed, but Iraq stood fast. We were alerted to deploy to an unspecified location in Southwest Asia, but everybody knew it was Saudi Arabia because Air Force Combat Wings and advanced party of the 82nd Airborne Division were already en route. We worked around the clock on the endless details of sending a heavy U.S. Army division to the other side of the world. When the 1st Cavalry deployed, I realized it would take the field with a new breed of soldier and revolutionary weapons. Army Chief of Staff General Carl Vono visited the division a few days later, and he and John Talilli held a discussion behind closed doors. When they came out, I had a new job. "Tom," General Talilli said, "the Army's going to frock you to Brigadier General." In the face of the forthcoming battle in Iraq, my promotion to Brigadier General was accelerated. Though my official date of rank would be July 1991, I'd pin on a star immediately. Then the other shoe dropped. Talilli had requested, and General Vono had agreed, that I become Assistant Division Commander for Operations and Maneuver, effective immediately. I would lead the division's advanced party to the desert. 23 years after 2nd Lieutenant Tommy Franks had boarded that Continental Airlines charter jet en route to Vietnam, I was now to be a Brigadier General and going to war again. Assembly Area Horse, Saudi Arabia, December 24, 1990. I did not expect a Merry Christmas. Everybody in the division tactical command post was worn ragged. In the previous 4 months, the 17,000 men and women of the 1st Cavalry Division had worked long days and nights completing our deployment to Operation Desert Shield. Leading the advance party into Saudi Arabia, I'd met with the commander of the 18th Airborne Corps, Lieutenant General Gary Luck, late on a hot, humid August night in the Arabian Gulf city of Dhahran. We would establish an assembly area where the division would stage thousands of troops and their equipment in the low dunes, 160 kilometers west of the port of Adamam. America's cavalry division was coming to town. We named the assembly area Horse in honor of the division's history. To the north, the 24th Infantry Division, Mechanized, and the 101st Airborne Division, Air Assault, had augmented the light infantry of the 82nd Airborne. During the first lonely weeks of August and September, those paratroopers had been positioned as a tripwire, the speed bump, in case Saddam Hussein decided to send his forces south into Saudi Arabia. While we labored through the stifling heat, setting up brigade and battalion positions that stretched across an expanse of featureless desert, diplomats at the United Nations were trying to persuade the Iraqis to pull out of Kuwait to prevent a war. And the Security Council passed 10 resolutions condemning the Iraqi aggression, which President George H.W. Bush had solemnly vowed would not stand. But Saddam rebuffed the world community, stubbornly insisting that Kuwait was now the 19th province of Iraq. The United States and its NATO allies formed a historic coalition that now included forces from Iraq's Arab neighbors. From the perspective of a soldier in the desert, war seemed inevitable. The air campaign against Iraq began at 0400 hours on January 17, 1991. Operation Desert Shield became Desert Storm. And around the clock for weeks, American, British, French, Italian, and Arab planes pounded the Iraqi army and command and control targets in and near Baghdad. When the bombing began, the division came under the operational control, that's OPCON, of General Frederick Franks, no relation to me, and his 7th Corps. At a conference held beneath the emerald tile domes of King Khalid Military City, General Schwarzkopf briefed the coalition's most senior leaders on the final Desert Storm plan. Rather than surging directly into the solid Iraqi defenses on Kuwait's borders, 7th Corps' heavy divisions would conduct an audacious left-hook maneuver toward the west and north. Then those divisions would wheel to the right and strike the enemy's exposed flank. Farther to the west, the lighter, faster units of the 18th Airborne Corps would leapfrog north to seize Highway 8 on the Euphrates River, blocking the Iraqi line of retreat toward Baghdad. An amphibious task force feinting a landing in Kuwait would freeze the eastern Iraqi divisions along the coast, and the two Marine divisions just inland would push through the enemy minefields and bunkers and roll straight toward Kuwait City. Surprise and speed were key elements of the plan, and so was deception. Deception was the responsibility of my 1st Cavalry Division. Our mission was to engage the 6 Iraqi Regular Army divisions defending the Wadi al-Batin in the south, and fix the Tawakana and Medina Republican Guards divisions in their positions farther north. A successful deception would exploit the Iraqi military doctrine that had evolved during the war with Iran, under which Saddam's commanders deployed expendable infantry divisions manned with draftees and reservists on the front lines as cannon fodder to slow enemy attacks, while retaining the more disciplined, well-equipped Republican Guards farther to the rear as counterattack forces. This was exactly how enemy forces were stacked when the air campaign began, and our job was to keep it that way. The major coalition ground attack began before dawn on G-Day, February 24, 1991. Following the plan, the heavy divisions of 7th Corps rolled across the flat desert into Iraq, moving north at high speed well west of the Iraqi army formations stacked up in fixed defensive positions in the Wadi al-Batin, the 1st Cavalry Division's main responsibility. To ensure the enemy remained where he was, the division sent Randy House's Blackjack Brigade up the Wadi, preceded by massed barrages of 155mm artillery and multiple launch rocket fires. The brigade fought savagely, with armored task forces racing up both sides of the valley, destroying dug-in enemy armor to the left and right before withdrawing south of the berm to join the rest of the division. That night, as the eastern sky blackened from hundreds of burning Kuwaiti oil wells the Iraqis had set ablaze, we were in tactical positions south of the berm being held as General Schwarzkopf's Theater Reserve, but when it became obvious the next afternoon that 7th Corps had moved deep enough into Iraq to begin its wheeling turn to the east to strike the enemy's exposed flanks, Schwarzkopf issued new orders. Send in the 1st Team, the 1st Cavalry Division. Destroy the Republican Guard. Let's go home. We headed west and north through the breach in the Iraqi lines that the 1st Infantry Division had cut on G-Day. Driving ahead in brigade wedges at the fastest possible speed, we slashed through the disorganized remains of 4 Iraqi divisions, destroying their remnants and leaving behind thousands of confused prisoners of war for the MPs, who followed us in a long support tail. A gale force Shamal sandstorm blew out of the west. The sky turned brown, then a dark rusty orange. The wind howled, and it began to rain. "Actually, sir," one of the command post drivers explained as he wiped the smeared windshield of his Humvee, "it ain't raining so much as what you'd call muddin'." Visibility dropped to less than 100 meters. Our minimum flying ceiling was gone and our helicopters were grounded. But the division pressed on. The thud of heavy guns sounded above the howling gale to the east. 7th Corps' armor was smashing into the flanks of the Tawakana and Medina Republican Guards divisions, still oriented to the south, waiting for a main attack up the Wadi al-Batn, an attack that would never come. We raced north. Well-trained M1A1 and Bradley crews used thermal sights to pierce the sandstorm, targeting Iraqi armor with cannon fire and TOW missiles. In the largest tank battle since World War II, the coalition was overwhelming the enemy. By late afternoon on February 27th, the wind dropped and the sky cleared. The 1st Cavalry's 800 tanks, Bradleys, and support vehicles had crossed 192 miles of desert in 33 hours, and they were formed up on the right flank of the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment, which was positioned near the northern point of 7th Corps. Ahead of us, the Hammurabi and Adnan Republican Guard divisions were scrambling away from the Wadi, hoping to escape up the Euphrates Valley on Highway 8. But the route was blocked by the 24th Infantry Division's northernmost brigade, and with the arrival of the 1st Cav, we now had enough armor and artillery firepower to crush the enemy's best combat units. Late that night at General Talelli's command post, the division's senior officers met to discuss the next day's operations. We had orders to refuel, rearm, and refit over the next 12 hours, and then to move forward to contact. As we examined the grease-pencil symbols on John Talelli's map, one of the staff officers scratched his jaw. "Well," he said, "Saddam is going to get his mother of all battles after all." Nobody laughed. I had just laid down to rest my eyes and was submerged in some kind of weird dream when the duty officer shook me awake. "Sir," he said with a big grin, "flash message from Corps. Cease fire in the theater effective tomorrow at 0800 hours. The war was over. Months of preparation, 100 hours of combat. It was in Desert Storm that I became convinced of the power of deception in warfare. It truly is a force multiplier. Through well-planned and deftly executed feints and ruses, the 1st Cavalry Division fixed in place enemy formations that vastly outnumbered us, sometimes by as much as 6-1. We used every available tool to convince the Iraqis that the division was the spearhead of a coalition assault up the Wadi al-Batn. And while the Iraqis waited, 7th Corps maneuvered through the sandstorms in the empty desert to the west and struck the Republican Guards in the flank like a sledgehammer. The world's most enduring strategic thinker, Sun Tzu, advised warriors 2,500 years ago to make your way by unexpected routes and attack unguarded spots. And that was exactly what coalition forces accomplished during Desert Storm. The result was, without doubt, the most impressive example of coordinated, flexible maneuver since General George Patton's 3rd Army drove across Western Europe in World War II. And the Desert Storm coalition relied on speed as well. For almost 200 years, the maxims of Prussian strategist Karl von Clausewitz had dictated that mass, concentrated formations of troops and guns, was the key to victory. To achieve victory, Clausewitz advised, a military power must mass its forces at the enemy's center of gravity. But the victory in Desert Storm proved that speed has a mass all its own. A fast-moving battalion of M1A1 tanks, in the right place, at the right time, has more destructive mass than a division of Republican Guard Soviet T-72 tanks, at the wrong place, sitting in defensive positions. The Iraqis had fielded more men, more tanks, and more artillery pieces than the coalition. What defeated them was the combination of superior technology, realistic training, and the fluid, flexible tactics of coalition forces. With its moat and 19th-century stone battlements overlooking the waters of Hampton Roads, Fort Monroe, Virginia seemed a strange setting for the Army's most innovative think tank when I got there in June 1992. But it was close enough to Washington for easy access to the Pentagon, while still far enough from the intrigues of the Beltway to allow the Louisiana Maneuvers Task Force to ponder the Army of the 21st century in a relatively tranquil setting. Army Chief of Staff General Gordon Sullivan, among the most innovative military leaders of the 20th century, was creating a futures laboratory and had chosen me as its director. As General Sullivan outlined the Army's overall situation, it was undeniable that the force of the future would be smaller than at any time since Vietnam. After the reunification of Germany in 1989, almost 300,000 soldiers and family members had been redeployed from Europe to the United States. The number of active duty Army divisions had fallen from 18 to 13 and was scheduled to drop to 10. Overall, the Army had cut its ranks by 400,000 soldiers and civilian employees, and Congress and the Pentagon were slashing budgets, eager to cash in on the peace dividend that was due following the collapse of the Soviet Union. The job of the LAM Task Force was to explore the potential of innovative technology, doctrine, procedures, and training to ensure that this leaner, warfighting force would also remain the world's most powerful. The context for this wide-ranging reevaluation was the idea that America would no longer require a huge, expensive ground force based overseas. Instead, the Army's warfighting units would be stationed in the continental United States and would be trained and equipped as a power projection force, able to deploy quickly anywhere in the world in time of crisis or conflict. 18 months after Operation Desert Storm, half of those Cold War units had been disbanded. When America went to war again, it would be with a smaller army. Our job in the LAM Task Force was to make sure that the Army could still win wars. Early in my work, it became obvious that future military operations would be much different from those I had seen in our long standoff against a monolithic, well-defined threat on the other side of the Iron Curtain. The Balkans were one current trouble spot, and then, of course, there was Iraq. Despite Iraq's lopsided defeat in 1991, Saddam Hussein's regime was still a destabilizing threat to the region. Soon after the March ceasefire, Shiites in southern Iraq rebelled against the Ba'athist government that had repressed them for decades, and Kurdish tribes in the north followed suit. But as the coalition forces withdrew, Saddam's military savagely crushed these revolts, massacring thousands and creating tens of thousands of refugees. The United States led a humanitarian assistance effort to rescue the Kurdish refugees starving in the northern mountains and the Shiites fleeing south to Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, implementing a new set of UN Security Council resolutions which required Saddam to stop the slaughter of his own people. The United States, Britain, and France imposed northern and southern no-fly zones in Iraq in 1991 and 92. Coalition forces had destroyed some stockpiles of chemical weapons before withdrawing from southern Iraq in April 1991. And that summer, UN weapons inspectors attempted to supervise the destruction of Iraq's remaining caches of poison gas and biological weapons, as well as precursor chemicals and biological growth media. The destruction of long-range Iraqi missiles and the dismantling of Saddam's nuclear weapons production plants were also on the inspectors' agenda. But the regime stalled, equivocated, and actively resisted inspections each time the UN teams got too close to sensitive sites. Controlled by UN sanctions and the no-fly zones, Saddam Hussein was temporarily contained, in the box, in Pentagon jargon. A tense standoff had begun. it would last for years. As I read each intelligence report on Iraq's dubious cooperation with the UN weapons inspectors, it was clear that Saddam's regime remained a threat. But Iraq was only one crisis zone that had flared up since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and units of a downsized U.S. Army were committed to many of these trouble spots, performing such non-traditional operations as peacekeeping, peace enforcement, humanitarian assistance, and drug interdiction. Between 1990 and 1995, the Army would conduct 47 major operational deployments, a 50% increase over the Cold War years. The mission of the LAM Task Force was to understand the geostrategic context of the 1990s and then to identify the force structure, weapons, and soldiers that the Army would need in the future to operate effectively in an increasingly dangerous and unpredictable world. In September 1992, our daughter Jackie, the little girl who used to fall asleep on the couch in our apartment waiting for her daddy Captain Franks to come home from the base, was marrying her own Army captain. Jackie had met Patrick Matlock at Fort Hood in 1990 when he was a first lieutenant in the 1st Cavalry Division's 332 Armor, one of the units that went on to fight so well during Desert Storm. Patrick was a sharp West Pointer on a fast track for command. Their wedding was in the New Post Chapel at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, the same church where Kathy and I were married. It was an emotional experience watching Jackie in her white gown looking very much her mother's lovely daughter on the arm of a young captain in Army dress blues, leaving that chapel under an arch of sabers. Somehow, 23 years had passed since the warm spring day when Kathy and I strode joyfully from that church, a beautiful young bride in white, on the arm of a young captain. My mother was there, brimming with happiness. At the reception, she looked at the Gulf War campaign ribbons on my uniform and asked her perennial question, "How much longer you got to do, son?" Mother never quite grasped that I was now a professional soldier, that I wasn't serving a set hitch as my father had done during World War II. I hugged her, feeling how light and frail she'd become since her cancer surgery in the 1980s. "Oh, Mother, it'll be a good while yet." Less than a year after Jackie's wedding, Kathy's mother, Gaynell, called with a message we had been dreading. "Your mother's gone, Tom." I'd thought I was prepared, but the news was still a cold shock. Mother's cancer had recurred. She'd moved to the suburbs of Dallas, where Gaynell had cared for her like she was an older sister. Gaynell had driven her to medical appointments, cooked for her in the small, assisted living apartment where she lived, and Gaynell had been with Mother at the end. As we spoke, I recognized again that the bond of love extended past the ties of blood. I was glad I'd saved a clean desert camouflage uniform. As always, Egypt's western desert was a dusty, fly-blown place, not a pleasant spot to fight a war, as the soldiers from the Pharaoh's armies to those of Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery had all discovered. At least the war we had just fought in the Bright Star 99 war game exercise had been relatively bloodless. There had been the usual injuries during training accidents, which was inevitable when 70,000 troops from 11 countries mixed it up for almost 2 months of realistic combat training, but we'd all survived. It was November 1st, 1999, and this was my second Bright Star since taking command of 3rd Army in May 1997. 3rd Army, Army Forces Central Command, ARCENT. That was the Army component of the United States Central Command, CENTCOM. And I'd just gotten word that Marine General Anthony C. Zinni, CENTCOM's Commander-in-Chief, was bringing Defense Secretary Bill Cohen to see our new deployable high-tech command center. We were on the south end of Mubarak Military City. The base was named after Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, one of several Arab leaders I'd met as I'd traveled the command's area of responsibility. That area of responsibility which stretched from the Horn of Africa through the Middle East to Pakistan. Over the past year, our area of responsibility had been expanded to include the STANs, the republics of former Soviet Central Asia. But I hadn't yet had a chance to visit exotic capitals like Tashkent in Uzbekistan or Dushanbe, which stood among ancient Mongol gardens beneath Tajikistan's snowy ridges. My three-year tour of duty as RSENT commander would end in spring 2000. Three-star generals were not promoted to four stars unless they were assigned to a position that required that rank. Kathy and I already had sketches of our planned retirement home in Texas. And if I had one resolution for my retirement, it was to spend more time with my granddaughter than I had been able to with Jackie. Jackie and Patrick had been stationed at Fort Knox, Kentucky, where Jackie had given birth to our first grandchild in June of 1997. Anne Catherine Matlock was named after her delighted and doting grandmother. I would have to wait until February 2000 for a similar honor, when Samuel Thomas Matlock would be born at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. But I would miss being a soldier. In civilian life, I expected to pursue a second career in the corporate world, and I hoped that my future colleagues would be as talented as those I'd leave behind in the Army. And I would also miss command, with its responsibilities and unprecedented opportunities to lead troops and find innovative solutions to difficult problems. Also, things were definitely heating up all over the area of responsibility, from the Horn of Africa through the Middle East and across Central Asia. Bill Cohen had a well-earned reputation as a thoughtful, decisive Secretary of Defense. When the staff lit up the plasma screens and ran the tapes of the Bright Star exercise, showing how the friendly coalition Greenland had defeated the aggressors of Orangeland, Cohen asked all the right questions. He seemed especially impressed that we had assembled the system using commercially available hardware. Our staff officers and sergeants were on their toes. They answered the Secretary's questions, and he left with a smile on his face. I was proud of that command post and of the young men and women who'd made it such a success. The next morning, General Tony Zinni dropped by as we were packing up for the flight back to Atlanta. Tony was in great spirits, which I attributed to the success of the Bright Star exercise. I couldn't help but return his smile. He was one of the friendliest senior officers I'd encountered in 35 years in the military, and also one of the smartest. A muscular fireplug of a guy in his mid-50s, Tony was raised in blue-collar Philadelphia by his Italian immigrant parents. His face looked like that of a tough, broken-nosed Roman emperor from a third-century coin. "Tom," he said casually, "where are you off to next?" "Christmas with the troops," I said, "probably in Saudi, Kuwait, Bahrain, and maybe Qatar." "When you return to the States, call me," he said casually. Then he added, "I've recommended to Secretary Cohen that you be my successor in CENTCOM when I retire next summer." I stared at Tony but had no voice to answer. CENTCOM Commander-in-Chief. Jesus! That was probably the most critical assignment in the U.S. military. "No guarantees, Tom, but I think Cohen likes the idea and we'll know more after the first of the year." Tony and I shook hands. He walked away as I tapped the digits of our home telephone number into my Iridium satellite phone. "Kathy, honey, how would you like to move to Tampa?" United States Central Command, MacDill Air Force Base, Tampa, Florida, April 24th, 2000. Like the other regional combatant commands, CENTCOM had been a creation of the Goldwater-Nichols Department of Defense Reorganization Act of 1986. These commands had no permanent forces of their own, but instead drew on the Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, and Special Operations Command to fulfill their missions. CENTCOM was responsible for maintaining stability in a region that spanned 25 countries, from Kenya and the Horn of Africa, north through the deserts of Sudan, Egypt, and Jordan, continuing across the Red Sea and Arabian Gulf through Iraq, Iran, and Afghanistan, and the former Soviet stands, right up to the Chinese border. Pakistan occupied the region's far right flank. The area was home to more than 500 million people, in 18 ethnic groups and countless tribes. They practiced all of the world's great religions and spoke 7 major languages and hundreds of dialects. Approximately 2/3 of this population was under 25 years of age, underemployed, and restless. Demographers call it a significant youth cohort. Military planners and diplomats call it big damn trouble down the road. These dissatisfied young people we knew represented millions of potential terrorist recruits. the region's economies were just as diverse and potentially just as volatile. The Neolithic realm of Eritrean nomads on the Horn of Africa wasn't far from the oil-rich Gulf Emirates. In Central Asia, the stagnant leftover perestroika of the former Soviet republics came head-to-head with overheated 21st-century capitalism. CENTCOM's area of responsibility included the historical land and sea crossroads linking Europe, Asia, and Africa, and it also held 65% of the world's known petroleum reserves. Outgoing CENTCOM Commander Tony Zinni gave me a briefing, an in-depth examination of the AOR. When we got to Iraq, we discussed Saddam's massacre of an estimated 300,000 Shiites and the status of the no-fly zones, as well as the regime's success at smuggling oil. Tony's view was that our national policy of containment was working. I agreed that we were containing whatever was happening inside Iraq within its borders. The problem in my mind was that we didn't know enough about what that was. After the UN weapons experts had been forced out in 1998, they had announced that Saddam may have produced and hidden thousands of liters of weaponized anthrax and botulinum toxin, more than enough to kill every human on Earth. I glanced at the wall map. What about Afghanistan? A failed state, Tony said. The Taliban has set the clock back to the Dark Ages. Afghanistan is Al-Qaeda's sanctuary. We destroyed some of the training camps in 1998, but terrorist recruits from all over the Muslim world keep flocking in. What else should I start to worry about? I wish I could tell you, Tony spread his big hands in resignation. You'll find out our intelligence picture for the region is pretty sad. That's another reason engagement is so important. We need friends out there who can give us the true picture. I'd like to know a lot more about what's happening in Iraq and with Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, but the fact is, I do not. Tony shook his head. Tom, don't be surprised if the CENTCOM you command is not the same as the one I've commanded. The only certainty in this region is uncertainty. As I rode back to the airfield to catch my plane for Atlanta, Tony's words weighed heavily on my mind. The only certainty in this region is uncertainty. I assumed command of CENTCOM on the 7th of July, 2000. As Tony had predicted, and as a necessary part of my new job, I spoke almost every day by telephone, sometimes on video teleconference link, with area commanders, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, foreign, civilian, and military leaders across the region, and I absorbed their concerns, and I was learning how they thought. Then on July 22nd, I began my first trip as CINC-CENT, Commander-in-Chief of Central Command, to my new area of responsibility. "It's an honor to meet you, Your Highness," I said. Crown Prince Abdullah's handshake was firm, his eyes bright. "How are you, General? How is the President?" Outside the tall windows of the Saudi Arabian summer palace in Jeddah, the Red Sea was shimmering in the heat. But this reception room was chilled by air conditioning ducts hidden behind alabaster screens. From a gold and silver pot, a servant filled the sev cup before me with tea. It was the 10th day of my trip, the fourth country I had visited. In Kenya, I'd learned of that nation's recent history of drought and natural disasters. In Kuwait, Bahrain, and Qatar, I'd reviewed with the Arab leaders the growing menace of terrorism, the threats posed by Iraq and Iran, and the status of military cooperation between our countries. Abdullah, my gracious host in Saudi Arabia, was the nation's de facto ruler, regent to his half-brother King Fahd, who had been crippled by a stroke in 1996. The Crown Prince was among the world's richest men. He was also a savvy politician who carefully balanced his positions as the protector of Islam's holiest sites and custodian of one of the world's largest reserves of oil. The industrialized world needed Saudi oil. Saudi Arabia grudgingly needed the military shield of the West. Unlike that of the Gulf states, whose friendship with the United States was based on mutual respect, Saudi Arabia's relationship with America was complex and highly charged. The presence of U.S. military forces in the kingdom, though a small fraction of its strength during the Gulf War, was a constant irritant to the Saudi population. Saudi Arabia was the home of fiercely xenophobic Wahhabism, one of the most fundamentalist sects of Islam. In November 1995, terrorists had exploded a car bomb at the Saudi National Guard headquarters in Riyadh, killing five American advisors. And 7 months later, on June 25, 1996, a huge truck bomb destroyed the American barracks at the Khobar Towers in Dhahran. 19 service members were killed, and hundreds were wounded. In the wake of these events, official Saudi resistance to our military presence increased. And there were more difficult problems in the relationship between our two countries. Many Saudis viewed America as Israel's sponsor and irrational ally, equally culpable in the repression of the Palestinians. Some wealthy members of the Saudi royal family funded Islamic schools, madrasas, worldwide, many of which preached virulent anti-Semitism and hatred for the West. And a few of these same influential Saudis backed the Taliban in Afghanistan, even though they harbored Osama bin Laden, who had pledged to destabilize the Saudi throne. After we exchanged formal greetings, the Crown Prince spoke his mind about Israel's tightening grip on Jerusalem, which he considered a threat to Muslim access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third most sacred site in Islam. The news that America might finally open its embassy in Jerusalem is very disturbing, the Crown Prince said. That would be official recognition of complete Israeli occupation of the Holy City. I'd been briefed on this subject, but was still new at diplomacy, not yet used to speaking.